This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Our topic in this portion of the program today, cancer. Among the things we'll talk about are recent advances in the treatment of cancer. New treatments are available. There are treatments that target specific kinds of cancer, and there are personal treatments. That is, they are designed for a particular individual. While this is very good news for people with cancer and their loved ones, it can be a challenge to sort through all the information out there and make sound treatment choices. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. C. Norman Coleman of the National Cancer Institute. Dr. Coleman is also the author of Understanding Cancer, A Patient's Guide to Diagnosis, Prognosis, and Treatment. Listeners, I invite your questions for our guest this afternoon, Dr. Norman Coleman. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Norman Coleman is Associate Director of the Radiation Oncology Sciences Program at the National Cancer Institute. His book, Understanding Cancer, A Patient's Guide to Diagnosis, Prognosis, and Treatment, is independent of his work at the National Cancer Institute. The book, now in its second edition, is published by the Johns Hopkins Press. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to talk with Dr. Coleman, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Coleman, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
Sure, my pleasure. There are many types of cancer. The causes vary, and you put it this way in the chapter that you devote to where cancer comes from. In essence, cancer is not a single disease, but many diseases. How does that complicate diagnosis and treatment?
Well, let me first give one qualification or one for this interview, and is that although I work for the National Cancer Institute, what I'm about to say is not official NCI policy. These are my own opinions and my own comments, so I'm sure your listeners will understand that. The idea that cancer was a single disease has been around for a long time, with the idea, why can't you simply cure cancer? It's now turned out with the molecular era, in which we're really beginning to understand the molecular biology of these diseases, is that what goes on to cause a cancer is very complicated, involving both the cell that becomes cancer, but also the cells that are nearby the cancer cell, which is called the microenvironment. So the revolution in molecular biology, as seen with the drug Gleevec for a chronic myelogenous leukemia, is really quite stunning.
And you know, we have these breakthroughs, and we have on the upside of the complication of, you know, that cancer is many diseases. The upside, there are many targets, many ways to go after cancer. So while it's complicated, there are ways to fight it. You want to give us some idea of the range of treatment options?
Sure. So let me start with some of the biology first. Cancer is really a genetic disease. There's something not functioning properly with the DNA of the cell. Now, people can misunderstand hereditary versus genetic. Genetic means the genes are defective. Heredity is a trait that one can inherit from a parent. Now, there are some hereditary tendencies, some people who have some changes in their genes that lead to an increased risk of cancer, but that doesn't necessarily mean they will get cancer. So if you look at the targets in DNA, the most common thing we think about is a gene mutation. So a gene is not functioning properly. By not functioning properly, it can produce a protein that is on in the wrong time. It's a protein that's defective, so the on and off switch for the protein can be defective. And the way the gene can be misregulated is in addition to mutations or duplication of a gene, there is a whole new field in gene silencing that we're learning that many genes are turned on and off by having other things stuck onto the gene, one called methylation. So the targets can be the gene itself, it can be the methylation pattern of the gene, it can be the gene protein. The gene protein itself can function in many ways. It can be a growth factor that the cell makes that tells its neighbors to grow. It can be a signaling pathway in the cell that makes a cell behave in a haywire fashion. It can be a defect in a death pathway. Now, what also surprises people is that cells have programs to commit suicide. They really can create their own death, and that's not surprising when you realize we have many cells, but organs stay a certain fixed size. So there is a program called programmed cell death, which if that becomes abnormal, that can lead to increased cell growth. We're also learning that cells are very dependent on their neighbors. So a connective tissue cell, a stromal cell, may produce a factor that's essential for the cancer to grow. So if you take a cancer that's growing in a breast and put it in a lung, it may not grow at all because it doesn't have the right soil. Mm. So if you look at molecular things, there's targets from the DNA to the proteins to how the proteins are functioning to cell-cell communication molecules. And the breakthroughs that are happening in specific cancer relates to these. There's also work showing that the immune response is somehow important in how a body responds to cancer. So jiggering the immune response is another way of potentially altering how the body responds to cancer. And there's also a number of technical advances that I can describe as well, but let me stop for now.
Yeah. You know, one may have a non-cancerous tumor. Is the mechanism for both similar?
Probably. There are some cancers that we know from genetic studies that grow in a stepwise fashion. Some, for example, is cervix cancer, where the disease is dependent on a viral infection. So in the presence of a viral infection, there'll be abnormal cell proliferation. There'll be cells will pile up. Now, what we call lining cells sit on top of a structure called the basement membrane. So if they're growing on top of the basement membrane and they just grow and grow and grow, they don't really cause any problems other than overgrowth. It's when they then pick up the capacity to invade, they can go from what's called a dysplasia to a carcinoma in situ, I-N-S-I-T-U, which means it's in sight, but it's becoming malignant, to an invasive cancer, to a metastatic cancer. So you can have cell proliferations that are pre-malignant, that don't have all the mutations or all the right settings for them to actually become malignant. So the purpose for screening is to try to pick up some of these cancers early. And the purpose of prevention also is to see if you can head off some of these cancers early, or in the case of cervix cancer, even vaccinate people against the virus that goes on to produce the cancer.
Yeah. What else can we do to prevent the development of cancer?
Some of cancer risk is the fact that we live long enough, and there's random mutations that go on from time to time, that the longer you live, the higher the risk of cancer. So it's a very common disease as you get into the older age groups. The obvious risk factors, the things you want to avoid, things like smoking. It appears in very complex ways that diet is involved in cancer. What seems to be a common risk factor for many cancers is having too much energy, too much food intake. So you're essentially overfeeding yourself and enhancing cell proliferation. For specific cancers, you want to go through screening. So for colorectal cancer, you should go through the appropriate colonoscopy at the right time in life. For breast cancer, the appropriate mammographic screening. What's happening now, too, is that there are risk factors being defined, both lifestyle but also potentially genetic factors. So if you have one of the breast cancer-associated genes, you should definitely undergo screening earlier in life. So we're beginning to, in the personalized medicine, is know who's at increased risk, so do the appropriate screening and prevention for those who have a high risk, or for those who have a much lower risk. You can pretty much leave them alone or do much less intensive screening.
Yeah. So cut back on risks, known risks, have yourself screened, and if there is a family history, that is really important, the screening, and as well cutting back on unknown risks.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things, I think I heard in NPR once when someone discussed what the new food triangle should be, and someone said it should be eat less and move. And I think that's a good way of going through life to avoid risk, not just for cancer, but for other diseases. I think to have a much better diet and remain physically active. I think in most studies that shows a decreased risk, or for many cancers, it seems to even be a better outcome for those who remain physically active on having a good diet. It's important to remember that life also deals us things that are just unfortunate.
Right.
So if people get these diseases, they shouldn't undergo many recriminations. You know, what did I do? Am I being punished? And I tried to describe that in my book, that some of this is just bad luck, and it's the things that happen with life, and when you have them, going back to understand why you got them is useful, but there comes a point where you have to say, well, this is just what I have to deal with, and then you have to figure out the best path forward through the appropriate staging and treatment.
Yeah. One of the things that I found comforting that you say early in the book is this: few cancers need to be treated as emergencies.
Yeah, I think that's key. And let me diverge a minute just to explain this whole book. And, you know, I've been an oncologist now. I'm trained in both radiation and medical oncology. I've been doing this for well over 30 years. And what I finally realized in my consultations were beginning to follow a pattern where I could never do it in 30 minutes. It always took me an hour and a half to 2 hours, an initial consultation. But what I found that people really benefited from is first understanding the terminology and concepts that doctors use in their thinking, then explaining their disease and some of the general options for their disease, and then focusing in finally on their disease itself. So they had a background of our terminology, they had a background of the various treatments, and then they can hone in on what they had. And so many consultations, they would say, oh, gee, now I understand what my issues are, and they were able to deal with it right away. What you find is that people feel pressured, and understandably so. I mean, these are horrifying diagnoses. Mm-hmm. So they often will sign up for something rather than realizing they have time to get additional information. Even in the most dire situation where there's a potential like a spinal cord compression or a fractured bone or even a brain metastasis, the initial treatment is usually to focus on that specific entity. So take care of the spinal cord compression, take care of the brain metastases. Then there's still this time to try to gather a little more information about what's the optimal treatments, what's available for me. I think people want to move quickly but not move in a panic mode. And I think it's really important for the doctor to help the patient calm down and realize that there is time to think this through.
Yeah, it's like going to the AAA for a triptych.
Yeah.
You know, you need a map. You need to know the place names.
And for some people, you have to know how the car works a little bit. So what is it that they're trying to lead me to and why? And it's amazing how much easier it is, not just for the patient, but for the patient to work with the healthcare team when they really understand the logic that goes into these decisions. They understand the disease. They understand the options. It's really great to see them begin to work and feel much more comfortable with good or bad news. They understand why the news is what it is.
Yeah. Now, there is a great deal of information out there. Do you have some advice about finding the information you really need without becoming overwhelmed with all the information that's available?
Yeah, the Internet is really something else. I think there are some well-edited websites. So the thing I recommend people do is the National Cancer Institute has a patient information site, and this is information that's very general but also specific. It's all peer-reviewed. It doesn't give one recommendations, but it gives legitimate options. It gives an explanation of the diseases It identifies clinical trials. So to me, that's really an excellent place to start. There are a number of books out there that are really good places to start as well. Some of the general textbooks or books on general oncology. American Cancer Society has information. A lot of cancer centers have information. I always have to be careful when I say that, but you have to always worry about getting information versus an advertisement. I guess the infomercial is the new term that we use. And so I think things like the National Cancer Institute website is a very good place to start. Most doctors try to do the best for their patients. So if the patient comes with a little bit of information and a patient doctor, I think it's a good chance that they'll work their way through and come to a good decision.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is very useful in your book, Understanding Cancer, is a discussion of risk, you know, assessing the risks and the likelihood of a good result in the short term and in the long term. You want to talk with us a little bit about that process?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So there's a lot of ways of determining what's considered success and what isn't, and some of the terms were developed for statisticians to do comparative studies. So, again, I use as an example, a patient's told they have a 50% chance of success following an operation. So the question, does that mean, is it a 50% chance you'll wake up from the operation, a 50% chance we'll get the tumor entirely out, a 50% chance you'll be cured forever? The same with chemotherapy or radiotherapy. Someone says there's an 80% chance of success after this treatment. Does that mean the disease will shrink, the disease will go away, the disease will go away and come back, the disease will go away and stay away forever? So there are a number of terms that we use in clinical medicine that I put in the book to help people understand the differences. So there's complete remissions, there's partial remissions, there's combinations of complete and partial remissions. And various studies will use different criteria when they report their data. It isn't that one is right or wrong. It's that you have to understand the terminology a bit. So I go through a fairly big discussion on that. Another concept is that of actuarial risk. In that, so you have a 50% chance of success. So that means you're going to be alive at 6 months, 3 years, 5 years. So there's mathematical ways that these data are illustrated, which I put in the book too, so people can understand. So if a doctor says you have a 50% chance of being in complete remission at 5 years, you have a piece of information that you could really deal with and understand what it means. And again, it's not a matter of the medical profession trying to be confusing. It's how we use data to compare one set of results from another.
Yeah. One of the things that you talk about in the risk analysis section of the book is the things that the doctor is considering when working with the patient, including these. Here's one of the questions, for example: when will the patient's cancer progress, and what problems is it likely to cause? Will the patient develop complications as a result of a particular treatment? Will the patient have serious problems caused by other medical problems that are unrelated to the cancer, severe heart disease, for example? So the doctor is working through a number of questions, a number of issues, and trying to come up with the best plan of attack.
Yeah, so that's an excellent pickup on your part. This is what we do in life almost all the time, but we don't call it as such, and that's really a competing risk analysis. So there's to be a good doctor, there's lots of things you really have to know. You have to know not just the disease, but you have to know disease in general, and you have to know the patient. And you have to also get some sense of what the patient's risk-benefit interests are as well. So it's all the things you said have to be considered. The success of treatment, you know, a very, very aggressive treatment that may have a 50% mortality to the treatment, but has a 10% long-term cure rate would be something a younger person may be more willing to take on than someone at an older mm-hmm. age. There are certain treatments, and we're seeing them now, too, that the late effects of some of these treatments occur many, many years later, and they're really surprising. Some of the heart ailments from chemotherapy years ago, we know some of the long-term effects from radiation. So you also have to try to put the person's lifestyle in context with what they're going to, what risk they're willing to take. And I think Lance Armstrong, although I don't know this for a fact, I think he had some of those discussions with his doctors about, do I take a drug that has some potential lung toxicity versus trying what I think at that time was an experimental drug that didn't have the lung toxicity. So the risk-benefit ratio of a certain drug for a Tour de France racer would be a lot different than someone who's a sedentary office worker. So there's so much that has to go into the risk-benefit analysis. So what I think is important is patients understand how we're using these numbers, how we're doing competing risks. One can then have a very, very good and detailed conversation about the treatment, the staging, the benefits, the various options, realizing that there's no one right answer for everybody, but there are a number of reasonable answers for any given person.
Yeah, and for most cancers, you say there's more than one possible treatment.
Yeah, it's off the top of my head, it's hard to think of anyone that has only one way of treating. There are often generic approaches that one uses in certain situations. But for any tumor, there can be different surgical approaches, there can be different staging, radiation techniques can vary, radiation dose can vary, the drugs can be different, whether you use a clinical trial or not can be different. There's usually an accepted standard of care, which even that will have some variability to what's considered reasonably standard care. And then there's the comparing of the standard care to the new therapeutics, almost all of which become available only during a clinical trial. So as you saw in the book, I really do emphasize clinical trials for a number of reasons. The least you get in the clinical trial is excellent standard therapy done in a very, very carefully prescribed manner, so there isn't arbitrary reduction of one treatment or another. And the option you get is usually to get standard treatment versus some other kind of new treatment or some variation on a theme. What the world also benefits in the clinical trials, it benefits from knowledge. So a disease in one population, say a Hispanic population, may be different than in a Caucasian population. And you won't know that going in, but in a clinical trial, you may find out the outcome of the disease is different. An example was lung cancer. When some of the EGFR inhibitors were used, these new molecular inhibitors were used in Japan versus the United States, and it turned out the Japanese results were different because the women with lung cancer really had a different molecular disease than the ones in the United States. So it wasn't that the trials had funny results. The results were very consistent with the biology. Were it not for that clinical trial, the difference in biology would not have been elucidated so easily.
Mm. Who's a good candidate for a clinical trial, and how do you find the right trial for somebody?
Well, in my opinion, everybody is a good candidate for a clinical trial, although for some diseases, the standard of care is really quite excellent.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, in almost any major cancer center, there are ongoing clinical trials. For some diseases, the clinical trials have given treatments that the standard of care is really superb, so there's no absolute need to be on the clinical trial. I think it's good for people, for almost everybody, to inquire if there's a trial. If the disease is highly curable, some of the trials now are backing off therapy. So you take a disease that has a very intensive regimen, and the question is, can I now give less treatment? Looking down the road, can I reduce potential toxicity? For diseases for which the prognosis is not very good, I surely recommend clinical trials, because the new and best therapies are only available initially during clinical trials.
Hmm.
So you can find out by going to the National Cancer Institute website. If you're near a comprehensive cancer center from the National Cancer Institute, they always have information on clinical trials. There's a phone number, I think it's 1-800-4-CANCER, that reaches the National Cancer Institute. And you can go to your physician. Many physicians are members of national cooperative group trials, so they'll have plenty of information in their office, and they have access to almost all the trials that there are. So it's worth discussing. A lot of people will not want to discuss it. Many people will say, gee, this is nice, but I'm not interested, and some people will be interested. But it's part of the searching technique for what you want to do, I think it's always worth considering being part of a clinical trial.
Cancer is our topic here this afternoon in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Our guest is Dr. Norman Coleman. He's Associate Director of the Radiation Oncology Sciences Program at the National Cancer Institute. He's the author of Understanding Cancer, A Patient's Guide to Diagnosis, Prognosis, and Treatment. It is independent. That book is independent of his work at the National Cancer Institute. And this afternoon, as he's talking with us, he is not representing the National Cancer Institute. The book is now in its second edition. It's published by the Johns Hopkins Press. Listeners, my name is Celeste Quinn, and I invite your questions this afternoon for our guest, Dr. Coleman. You can join us with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Yes, hi. I have a question and a comment. My question is, does your book deal with alternative therapies? And also a comment. I was reading about dendritic cell treatment, which isn't done here in this country because the pharmaceutical-based philosophy of the medical establishment prevents research being done on alternative therapies, and so the focus tends to be chemo and radiology. And I was wondering if your book addressed alternative therapies and your comment about these other explorations being done in other countries such as dendritic cells.
Yes, thank you for the call. Yes, I do address alternative therapies, at least in a general sense, in that it's clear that there are active ingredients in some of these therapies, some of which are the natural ingredient, and from time to time there are episodes where when these alternative therapies are studied in the laboratory, they're found to have some either chemotherapeutic agent or other known hormonal therapy in them. So I think I address alternative therapies in that these are certainly personal decisions, and I think what's very important is to make sure that if someone's considering alternative therapies, they do discuss that with their doctor. Some of these therapies, again, do contain active ingredients. They may be anti-cancer ingredients. They may be ingredients that can alter the metabolism of other drugs that one is taking. So some can be potential radioprotectors and so forth. So the most important thing is for people to be straightforward. I think most doctors are very happy to discuss alternative therapies in general terms. Whether or not they recommend them or not is up to them. But I think it's important to have this open discussion.
Have you heard of the dendritic cell treatment where they're basically drawing these cells from the patient's own body and reintroducing it?
Yeah, so where dendritic cells coming, it's a very interesting part of vaccine therapy. So dendritic cells are one of the immune processing cells. So it's when a body is exposed to new antigens or new proteins, the dendritic cells are cells that are involved in processing these new proteins and handing them off to lymphocytes or other effector cells. So in fact, a lot of the vaccines now being developed involve the use of dendritic cells. Dendritic cells are in the lymph nodes, they're in the skin, they're elsewhere in the body.
And they're doing that in this country?
Yes. I can't say off the top of my head if they're being used in clinical trials, but I think they may be. But certainly there's a tremendous amount of interest in these in immune processing. It's how research has really led to the understanding of how the body musters a response to things it has to muster a response to, but doesn't muster a response against itself. So, yes, dendritic cells are being studied.
Okay, thank you. Good luck with your book.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Others are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's go back and talk about the standard methods that have been with us now for some time, surgery, chemotherapy, radiation. Have there been changes in how these therapies are administered in recent years?
Oh, dramatically.
Yeah.
So for surgery, the whole idea of surgery really has two uses. It's used to remove the primary tumor, and it's also used for staging to get some sense of where the disease is. So for staging, for example, the technique's now called sentinel node biopsy. So if you have a disease like a melanoma or some other disease and you want to see if the lymph nodes are involved, rather than dissecting many, many nodes, either a radioisotope or a color compound is injected near the primary lesion. This is then followed to the nodes that pick this up. So these are called the sentinel nodes. And then just a few of the sentinel nodes are removed. If those are normal, then it gives you a very good idea that there's no nodal involvement. So one can get a lot more staging information with a lot less morbidity, a lot less destructive surgery. Surgery is also being used much, much more in combined modality therapy. So way back a while ago, years ago, breast cancer is a perfect example where extended radical mastectomy was used. The thinking was that one had to not just remove all the primary cancer, but one had to remove a wide berth of tissue around it. What's happening now in many disease sites is that there's a lot smaller surgical excision. Breast cancer is an example. One has a lumpectomy, and then the surrounding area is treated with radiation, so the treatment is much, much less morbid. For rectal cancers, one can almost do just an excision and then use radiation to clean up the surrounding area. Or in some instances, radiation and chemotherapy are used first, and then surgery is only used to remove the tumor that the radiation and surgery don't actually get rid of themselves. So I think surgery is much more precise, is much less morbid. The endoscopic surgeries and the laparoscopic surgeries are also much easier for people to undergo. Hospitalizations are much shorter, and in fact, sometimes the operation is even better because you get better visualization with a scope than you do necessarily opening up the patient.
And radiation is much more targeted.
So imaging has been another major advance. So in addition to the plain old X-rays, we now have magnetic resonance imaging, we have PET scanning. Mm. So these help define the targets where the tumor is predominantly. The techniques in radiation, intensity-modulated radiation therapy, proton therapy, and others are designed to really target the much higher dose to the tumor itself and to spare more of the normal tissue. There are other techniques called brachytherapy where radioactive sources are put into the tumor for either a permanent placement or a short-term placement. Immunotherapy is now becoming part of the standard treatment. The cervix cancer vaccine is really amazingly revolutionary. There are other examples of immunotherapy being used as part of treatments for lymphomas and melanoma. And again, immunotherapy has been around for decades, but I think now as we begin to understand the immune response, we're really beginning to make some headway.
Mm.
For chemotherapy, and I put a whole new chapter in the book for molecular targeted therapy, it turned out that even chemotherapy of the old days was molecular targeted. As we understand how it worked, we do understand now some of it was more specific than we thought it was. But now there are drugs being developed, Gleevec being the perfect example of one, that actually targets a specific mutation or a specific pathway. So the idea of design of therapies may someday be that you can do a genetic profiling of a tumor, find out what the defect or defects are, put together a combination of treatments, either drugs or a combination of radiation plus drugs or a combination of immunotherapy plus radiation or so forth, and really target what a specific patient could use.
I've got a couple of listeners waiting for us, so
sure.
Let's go next. Because one of the things I do want to talk about before we run out of time, though, I think this is amazing, pharmacokinetic profile. But anyway, let's go next to talk with a listener on a cell phone on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife is a cancer survivor, and I had two questions. And one is, what effect does someone's mental state have on how they recover from chemotherapy and radiation and their cancer survival rate overall? I was wondering if there's been any study done about that. And then also, my wife's taking tamoxifen. I understand that there's a whole new generation of post-treatment medication that is available now, and what breakthroughs and good things you see happening from that.
Yeah, the first question is an interesting one because there are varying results of the effect of mental state on recovery. Some studies have shown some benefits, some shown that it really doesn't make a difference. Without knowing the answer, I generally try to recommend people be as upbeat as they can, but I think it's also fair to say that going through these diseases and these treatments really have some serious downtime, and I think people are really it's fair enough to respect that. I think to try to push people to have a better attitude because it'll affect their outcome really isn't so justified. The data that show that mental state makes a major difference are not necessarily reproducible in various studies. So I think a good attitude is good. One has to be patient and fair with the patient because of what they're going through. So tamoxifen, there are new sons and daughters of tamoxifen that seem to have some of the fewer side effects of tamoxifen that people are now switching over to. So I think if she should talk to her oncologist, or she's on one of these long-term tamoxifen courses. Again, they seem sometimes when a major breakthrough sounds like it's enormous difference, sometimes it's only a small difference. So another point I try to make in the book is if you change something, a complication rate from 1% to 2%, that only affects 1% of the people, but it's actually 100% improvement in the complication rate. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you have to look at how the statistics are being done. So 25 to 50, 1 to 2 is the same 100% improvement. So some of these improvements in the tamoxifen-like drugs are better, but tamoxifen itself is still an effective drug. But it's definitely worth talking over with her oncologist.
Let's talk with another listener. Also on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Yes, thank you for your information. It's very helpful. My wife had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 1988, treated with MACOP-B and then radiation. My question is, now 18 years later, any health impacts from being treated with those, any things we should be watching out for?
Yeah, there's some very recent data suggesting that the people who have had Adriamycin a long time ago can have some heart dysfunction later on. So I think, and again, depends on the area that was irradiated. Radiation scarring can also create some problems later on. Usually by 18 years, you would probably have seen some impact on that. And if she's feeling well and going about life fine, that's probably okay and probably not worth worrying much about. So the only thing is she should perhaps discuss with her internist or cardiologist is to make sure there's no subtle heart defects going on that they may want to follow just to be aware of. But that's congratulations on being 18 years out. That's fabulous.
Well, yeah, it's wonderful. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome. Well, let's now talk about this idea of the pharmacokinetic profile. This is a way that the team can figure out what the right dosage for an individual is.
Yeah, so it's not surprising to when you look at people on the street to realize that we all handle we'll metabolize drugs and other things differently. So in a pharmacokinetic profile, what's determined in the laboratory or in the clinic, there's a certain target drug concentration that you want to achieve. And you may want to achieve that certain concentration for a period of time called the concentration times time. So what would happen is that during the first dose of drug, the plasma levels would actually be measured. And you get a curve of concentration times time, and you create what's called the area under the concentration times time curve. So rather than giving a specific dose to a patient, you know the relationship between the dose you gave and their area under the curve. So the second dose can be given to create a certain area under the curve. So someone who metabolizes drug more rapidly would need more drug. Someone who metabolizes drug more slowly or clears it more slowly would take less drug. And this is a good way of hitting the target concentration without exceeding toxicity.
Yeah. And this is available for some drugs, not all at the moment.
Right.
Will more of this profiling be available in the future?
Oh, definitely. And that's, again, part of the new molecular therapeutics is, in fact, you know a certain drug concentration you need to inhibit a pathway. If you can't achieve that concentration, forget it. So, in fact, this kind of information may be a very, very quick way of deciding whether a drug really has some potential efficacy or not. And the whole world of clinical trials is being refined to take into account this pharmacokinetic relationship between drug dose, serum concentration, plasma concentration, tissue concentration, and biological efficacy. So it may be you can not only tailor-make the drug, but you can also tailor-make how you're giving the drug.
Mm. I suspect that this is happening all across the field of medicine.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Another thing that I think we might want to talk about here in terms of how things are changing and how the changes are making a difference in the lives of people with cancer. An acquaintance of my husband and I, a woman is going to have, she has cancer. She's going to have her chemotherapy delivered by a pump. So it will be an ongoing process. She can go about as much as she's able her life. She can travel. She can be at home.
Yeah, it's, you know, for someone who's been in this business for over 30 years, it's really amazing to see how many advances have been made, not in reducing morbidity of the ultimate treatment. Making sure that there's a functional patient at the end with organ preservations and
quality of life along the way.
Yeah, and right, even along the way. Like for some diseases, you're willing to take whatever toxicity you need, but now it's turning out that you don't need all this toxicity. The antiemetics are really substantially better than before. A lot of the treatments are done as outpatient treatments now. The kind of patients you see in the hospital now are much different than they were 15 or 20 years ago. Many more patients are treated as outpatients. It's really remarkable. And this is done without compromising results. So it's really fantastic. So a lot of the breakthroughs, you know, people look for the great breakthroughs. And it's really almost it's a marathon run that each step along the way, as you do a little bit better, the ultimate outcome improves. And I can say the world of cancer is doing better by toxicity, doing better by biology. It's frustratingly slow. I mean, those of us who work in the field literally work seven-day weeks because we'd like to get rid of this disease. We certainly appreciate the public support for research, for participating in research, and also for the Congress support for cancer research. And we appreciate the public being involved as a survivor movement and all the patient advocacy groups that not only help patients but also help doctors do their jobs better.
Hmm. Well, there we'll leave it. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, my pleasure.
Dr. Norman Coleman has been our guest in this portion of the program. He's Associate Director of the Radiation Oncology Sciences Program at the National Cancer Institute. He is the author of Understanding Cancer, A Patient's Guide to Diagnosis, Prognosis, and Treatment. The book is independent of his work at the National Cancer Institute. The book is now in its second edition. It is published by the Johns Hopkins Press.